I offer my humble salutations at the divine lotus feet of Bhagwan, my Lord, guide and friend. Sai Ram. Welcome to the 2012 Isharamba Day celebrations hosted by Sai Centers of Chicagoland. We have an exciting program today to remember the mother's love, Isharamba's love for Bhagwan, such a simple life, desireless life she has led, and such a great message for us. So we have two guest speaker sessions today, very inspiring sessions by Brother Sundar Iyer, and then an exciting program by the SSC children of Chicagoland Centers. Most of us go to Bhagwan with a list of desires and wants, and then there are some like me who sort them in an order so to make it easy on Bhagwan. There are few who actually leave it to Bhagwan and let him drive, just go to Parthi for his pure love. And then there are very, very few like Mother Isharamba who actually think of Bhagwan's comforts, who's all, just his pure love is all she wants. So let me narrate a small incident to explain what that means. So this happened many years after Mother Isharamba has passed away. One day, Bhagwan was getting ready for a darshan around 2:30 or 3 in the afternoon. Bhagwan uses this thin thread, you call it Maltadu in Telugu, to tie his angi, the robe, to his waist. That day, Bhagwan noticed that the thread is loose and it's about to break. So he ordered the boys to get a new thread. As this was happening, as the boys were rushing out, one of the trust members offered him his belt to tie around his waist, and Swami refused. And the devotees were waiting. And then suddenly Mother Isharamba appears in physical form in Swami's room. This is many years after she passed away. And then Swami says, "Why are you here?" And she says, "Swami, you gave me this gold chain when I was alive. I don't need this anymore. Why don't you take this and tie it to your waist?" Such is the love she has for Bhagwan. It's a unique combination of a motherly love for a son as well as divine love for Bhagwan. So we are indeed fortunate to have this program today to remember her love. And then we are it's a great pleasure to have an inspiring speaker with us today, Brother Sundar Iyer. A brief introduction about Brother Sundar Iyer, or I should say Dr. Sundar Iyer. He is the alumni of Satya Sai Institute of Higher Learning. He was the first batch of students to join Swami's College. He did his graduation, master's, as well as PhD in banking and finance from Satya Sai Institute. During his years as a student, he has many, many experiences and interactions with Bhagwan. He was so fortunate to be his personal assistant for about 2 years or so. In 1992, Swami performed his wedding with Miss Maya in his interview room. So we are very fortunate to have with him today. Brother Sundar has a great pleasure, and he's excited about yoga and meditation in teaching, learning, and practicing. So in fact, he practiced yoga and meditation at his divine feet. And he was even trained and guided by some of the great saints and yogis and some Himalayan masters who were either visiting Parthi and or during his interactions. So he uses yoga and meditation as a technique to spread Swami's message around the world, and he traveled to many places conducting meditation camps and yoga camps. He even recently spoke at many centers, including Cleveland Clinic, the mosque in Toledo, among other places. So indeed, we are very fortunate to have with him today. Without further ado, please join me in welcoming Brother Sundar Iyer. A quick announcement, we will have a Q&A session with Brother Sundar Iyer this afternoon. So we'll be passing along a piece of paper. So if you have any questions, please write them down and pass it along to us during the lunchtime. Sai Ram.
Thank you. Om Sri Sai Ram. Dear brothers and sisters, let me begin by offering my most prayerful, my most humble and loving pranams and salutations at the feet of my most beloved Lord, Master and God, Sathya Sai. I would like to begin by thanking Brother Shankar and Brother Krishna for their wonderful hospitality and for giving me this opportunity to share my faith and inspiration in Swami. Every time I speak about Swami, I feel very humbled, very privileged, and I consider it one of my greatest good fortunes that I'm given this opportunity to become his instrument, which has been, which is, and which will continue to be my prayer, to be an instrument of a master so divine as he. As I was talking to Krishna today, I always have a starting problem with Swami. And once I start speaking about him, I have an ending problem. So I have this wristwatch. Hopefully I'll stick to the time. Because where does one begin talking about a master as divine, as powerful, as beautiful, as magnanimous as Sathya Sai? And once you start talking about him, you get so lost in his glory, in the leelas that he performed, in the powerful teachings that he had, you don't know when to stop. But nevertheless, we have chosen to be bound by time, as we often choose to be bound by time and space, and so this is no exception. So this presentation has a beginning and will come to an end. But as my brother Prasad put it, if in the course of this of my talk, if you do have some thoughts that you want to ask, feel free to write it in that piece of paper and we'll take it up in the afternoon. I may not have answers to it, but I can share my perceptions to your questions if there are any. And I always encourage people to come forward with their questions simply because this is a spiritual satsang. It's not an entertainment event. You're not come here to listen to a music program or something, just you have a good time and you go back. You come here so that there is something you hope to take home that touches your heart, that touches your spirit, that awakens you. That is the purpose of a satsang. Otherwise, it's merely a program. It's a social event. That is what differentiates a satsang from a social gathering. A satsang is satsang, a company where we discuss fundamental truths of life. And hopefully, if each one of us can take home any message, however small that message is, something that we take home to practice, I think all our job here would have been achieved. You may not remember everything and anything, but all of us always hear what we are supposed to hear. Something during my speech or my presentation, something during the kids' presentation, something will touch your heart. Take that home, nurture it, allow it to grow, and that will take you to the next step. One of the things that has inspired me most, having lived with Bhagawan, is the way he conducted himself, the way he lived every day in and out. And like I said yesterday evening, for those of you who were there in the satsang, is let us for a moment resist the temptation of putting Bhagawan into a picture frame and putting him up there in an altar and say, oh, he is God, he can do it. That's okay for him. Great leelas, and we put him away, far away from us, at a distance, where these masters come in a human form to tell us, hey, I can be like you because I want to teach you how you can also be divine. So he has come to awaken us to believe in our own true spirituality. He has come to awaken us so that you and I can one day feel and say that I am divine. I am the God I seek. Sai and I are one. That is not blasphemy. Don't think it is humility to say, I am just a devotee. I have not reached that level yet. If you say that, you will be saying that 70 years from now, 100 years from now, and you teach that to your kids, it's okay, Baba, you're not enlightened now. You're a small kid, enlightenment will come, now just be. So we teach our kids not to feel you're enlightened. And then they will teach their kids. Then when will enlightenment ever come? Master walks the earth and says, I am God. Oh my God, can I touch your feet? Yes. But then he whispers also, you are also God. The only difference is I am aware of it and you aren't. So in the course of the next 45 or 50 minutes that I have, I hope to present these lessons that I learned from Swami and how simply he taught us not just that we are divine, but he also taught us ways to achieve this. Because the next obvious question is, okay, it's fine to say I am divine. How do we get there? What is it that we need to do? We know the answers ourselves, but we need it to be spelt it out again and again and again. Just like we tell our kids, how many times I will tell you not to do it and you keep doing it, right? That same thing we tell God, please tell me again and again, the same things again and again. And we love to listen to it because it has to get dinned into our thick skulls, if you will, that there are ways and means to actually perceive divinity within ourselves and to feel one with the cosmic divine principles that is the fundamental basis, and all this other creation is our own leela, is our own illusion. The first and foremost message that I took from Swami, the tool that I took from Swami, that not only inspired me, but I knew was a fundamental basis for this entire path of spirituality, is one word: discipline. It's fascinating to see how this master, who was visited by thousands and thousands of people every day, who barely had to lift his handkerchief to wipe himself because there'll be so many people doing that, who barely had to move because people are ready to drive him around. In his private quarters, he lived a very rigid, a very disciplined life. For him, silence was absolute silence. Simplicity was his very core. When I was a youngster and I went and saw Baba sitting on silver thrones and 5-6 sevadals behind him with handkerchiefs, and he takes an envelope from somebody, somebody is there to take it from him, I'm like, wow, this is comfort. So it didn't get to me what when he talked about discipline and simplicity and especially sealing on desires. I said, but look at him, he's sitting on a silver throne. So when the first time he asked me, what do you want, very hesitatingly, I said nothing. But he said, no, tell me, what do you want? Chepu, chepu. And finally I said, I want to be with you in your room, because I wanted to observe what he does in his room. Having been brought up in a very religious, orthodox setting, I had seen enough sadhus and saints and heard everybody talk about simplicity and vairagya, but I wanted to see this. And that is where my faith in Swami, my faith in his divinity, my curiosity turned to admiration, admiration turned to devotion, and finally led to surrender. It is just watching him live as a human being. Not his materializations, not the fantastic leelas, and not the stories that I heard from those who were close and near to him, but watching him in and out as a youngster would, very curious. When I walked into his bedroom the first time, I was like, is this his bedroom? I couldn't believe, because it's just a single bed, hardly any light, a bathroom which is barely 4 feet by 4 feet. And then I saw simplicity in action. I've seen and heard, and I'm sure all of us have seen, people who publicly are simple and portray simplicity and who live a private life which is completely different. But this was exactly the opposite. In public, he was like a king. But when he was alone, he was pure God. And that is where I understood when he said, among men, I am a man. Among women, I am a woman. Among children, I am a child. Alone, I am God. Alone, he was within four walls, which would have driven you and us and me mad in 10 days, within four stone walls. But for him, there was a secret of a secret source within him, where he found infinite freedom, infinite wisdom, infinite love, and the capacity to give, therefore, was infinite in his nature. And therefore his mission took one day at a time, 1 week, 1 month, 1 year at a time. But look how many millions of people it has touched. So discipline was one of the key things I learned from Swami. And I think we can use that discipline for our own ceiling on desires. How much we run and chase wealth and prestige. You might say, I'm not. But if you look at the priority in your life, what is the priority in my life? Oh, my meditation in the morning. My meditation is a priority. Everything else revolves it? No, my priority is my work. It's not wrong. But I just want us to introspect and ask, what is my priority in life? And why is this my priority? You know, Bhagawan one day was in Vrindavan, and this is the old Vrindavan, old bungalow, and he was walking to feed the deers and all, and on his way back, he just paused, and he was looking at those, you know, in India, you have these big ants, I think they're called carpenter ants, right? The big ones, the big black ones. And somehow, that is associated with Ganesha, I don't know why, though. Now, this carpenter ant had a big leaf it was trying to pull and take it across. And Swami just stopped. And all of us, because Swami is looking down, we also looked at what he was watching. He was keenly watching that ant pull that leaf, a dried leaf or a twig or something like that, and he was pulling it across. And then there was a place that there was a big gap in this thing. The ant paused. And then it went and pushed the leaf across and walked on top of the leaf, then continued to pull. And Swami was saying, Chudu, good intelligence. But finally, when it went to a corner where it has to go into its hole, it couldn't take the leaf in. So it left it inside and went inside. Swami watched the whole thing. The whole thing took about 2 minutes or so. He watched that whole thing and he said, there is no difference between that ant and your buddhi. You spent your entire life chasing, education, dabbu kavala, education kavala, degree lu, anni teeskule elthunaru. You take everything and carry this burden. And then finally, when it's time to leave, what do? You leave it behind and go. So all that we are chasing for in life, what is the purpose? Where are we going to take it? Where are we going to take it? Are we going to take it with us into the next world? We have seen people leave everything behind. We have heard people do that. Yet we somehow, in back of our mind, we think we are going to take it. Somehow that illusion is so deeply engraved into us. And Adi Shankara says this beautifully in his Bhaja Govindam. And let me share that with you with this song. And you know, when you before I go there, when you think of Krishna and Rama, it is the same thing. Rama and Krishna were kings, but because they shunned, their priority was different. Wealth followed them. Prestige followed them. Everything followed them because they had the divine knowledge with themselves. Swami shunned everything. At 8, he said, I'm not even going to school. Everything that you and I think is important for our careers and we teach our kids, he said, I don't want this. And he chose to be divine, and everything came to serve his purpose. So let us not be afraid that because we choose spirituality, we're going to lose everything. And let us not seek spirituality because hoping we'll get this and more. Either way is bad. Just seek spirituality because that is the ultimate truth. And through this discipline, you chant the name of God. And so Adi Shankara says, Bhaja Govindam, Bhaja Govindam.
मूड जहे धनागम तृष्णा मूड जहे धनागम तृष्णा कुरु सद्बुद्धि मनसि वितृष्णा यल्लभसे निज कर्मोपातम् यल्लभसे निज कर्मोपातम् वित्तं तेन विनोदयचेतम् वित्तं ಕರುಣೋದಯ ಚೇತ್ತಂ ಕೃಷ್ಣ ರಾಮ ಕೃಷ್ಣ 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 ರಾಮ ರಾಧೇ ಕೃಷ್ಣ ಕೃಷ್ಣ ರಾಮ 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 ರಾಮ
ಲೆಟ್ಸ್ ಸಿಂಗ್ ಟುಗೆದರ್ ಕೃಷ್ಣ ರಾಮ ಗೋವಿಂದ ಗೋಕುಲ ನಂದನ ಗೋಪಾಲ ರಾಮ ಕೃಷ್ಣ ಗೋವಿಂದ ಜಯ ಬೃಂದಾವನ ಗೋಪಾಲ ಸಾಯಿ ಕೃಷ್ಣ ಗೋವಿಂದ ತ್ರೈ ಬೃಂದಾವನ ಗೋಪಾಲ ಗೋಪಾಲ ಸಾಯಿ ಗೋಪಾಲ that you take, the easiest way when things become difficult is chant the name of God. Adi Shankara, in spite of Advaita and all the Vishishta Advaita and the treaties on Viveka Chudamani and Atma Shatakam and everything that he shared, finally he sat down and said Bhaja Govindam. Simple. Let's spell it out for you. Simple. Bhaja Govindam. Chant the name of God. Sing the glory of the God. So having done the first D comes the next D. The second D I took from Swami was the sense of duty, the sense of purpose. I think that was crucial. The way he was completely absorbed in what his mission was. Dharma or righteousness, as Swami would often say. The true dharma, okay, dharma of a parent is being a parent, the dharma of a husband is to provide for his family, the right, you know, what is my dharma, my purpose? All these are small purposes, but the true purpose, as Bhagavan says, the true purpose, the true dharma is to realize you are divine. And therefore the question comes, so when is the right time to start? If you talk about a small child, he says, no, he's too small to understand. So let them play there, we'll put them with somebody to monitor the kids, let them be playing. We will discuss high spirituality, that is too much high for them. You know, they won't understand. So the kids don't understand, fine. So then as they grow into youngsters, they are too busy, caught up in acquiring talent. So he sings well, he is into drama and all. Now don't confuse him with all this high philosophy. Let him pick up talents. And then he becomes a youngster. He's too caught up in his career, studies, college, education. Too much work. Where is the time? Don't confuse my kid, please. Too much satsangs, I'm afraid he might not choose his right career. And then he, before he realizes that he is, becomes like you and me, right in his middle age, and he says, what did I do with my life? What is the purpose of my life? So when is the right time to start? So if you wait for the right time doesn't come. Now is the right time to start. And again, as Swami would say, when you're too old, when your body is tattering or tottering and your body is filled with disease and you can hardly speak, you cannot even hear, at that point, if you think I'm going to start sadhana, it is too late. Do it when you have the strength. Because this is a temple of God. God has given this body to us. We have taken this, evolved to this point where we have used these instruments to evolve. And now at this point, we are stagnating. But at this point, if we use the breath, the body, the mind to realize our inner divinity, at this point, when it is all in a good functional state, we can use them to understand, appreciate divinity. You know, one Swami had a glass and there were peanuts, a small bowl of peanuts we would always keep for Swami. And as he was talking, he removed the cover of his glass of water. He took one peanut and dropped it like that into that. And it created a ripple. And he told the boy, stop this ripple. And that boy next to him was like, how do I stop it? So he lifted it, it created more ripple. He kept it down, it was still rippling. He tried to put his hand, Swami said, stop it, stop it. He tried to put his hand, how can you stop it? By putting your hand, it created more ripples. Swami said, once the ripple is created, it is too late. The best way to stop is, don't drop this peanut into this. Don't drop the peanut into the water. So we seek spirituality when there is trouble in life. Artha, artha, arti, jignasu, gnani. We seek spirituality when there is illness in life. Oh my God, Swami, please help me. Ah, miracle happened. That awakens. Okay, fine. At least that started you off. But we seek God when there is a trouble. Just like we seek dieting and good health when the doctor tells you high cholesterol, high triglycerides. Oh my God, Sundar, can you help me with some yoga program? The peanut is already dropped into the water. We want to learn swimming when we fall off the boat into the river and we don't know when we are drowning. That means, oh, teach me swimming. It's too late. Just grab something. When do you learn swimming? Come home, think about this, and then go to the pool. When everything is going fine, you learn swimming, so you never get to the point where you drown. So once the peanut is cast into the water, once there is ripple in the mind, then calming the mind is no use. So we have to think before the stone is cast. So don't wait for, oh, spirituality come when we grow old. By then, you have cast too many peanuts into the bottle, into the glass of water. There's too much ripples. It's too late at that time. It's too late at that time. And again, Adi Shankara puts this beautifully. And let's share this through song.
Yavadvito parjana saktaha stavan nija parivarura.
When you're old and your body is frail, even your own kith and kin won't take care of you. They'll shun you and put you away. At that point, what are you going to chant the name of God? Only now, if you do it, then Murari will come to help you at that time.
Yavadvito parjana sakta stavanija parivaro ratta pasya jivati jal jarade vartam ko pina prishchati de vartam ko pina prishchati de sai sundara sundara sai sundara sundara ananta guna mandira
he believed he was truly beautiful, he was truly divine. Right from his 8th grade, he never lost that beauty, even when he was 85. How charming was he? Every day, every photograph you see of Swami, there is divinity that's flowing through his eyes, through his actions, through his face. It's marvelous because he never grew old. He was always divine. And that seed he sowed when he was young. And he teaches us that very same principle. So our main duty, if you will, is to realize that we are divine. That is our duty. Every other duty follows suit, falls in place automatically. And then the third D I learned from him was discrimination. As a youngster, we were all, oh, I can do gymnastics, I can do this, I can do that, I have intelligence, I have talent, I have beauty. And we are so proud of this youth that we have. Not realizing that all this goes away over a period of time. And this is passing. The intelligence that we gather, that all the skills that we have gathered, we hold on to it. We have to learn to discriminate and say, you know what? This is the phase in life, and this will pass away too. This will pass away too. No, there is no amount of worldly intelligence that can be brought down. And there's a very beautiful story I read, a kind of a riddle, if you will, where a young prince who's extremely proud, a ruthless prince, the bad guy, who was very proud of his youth and beauty and power, would go around and put the poor peasants and farmers in his kingdom in trouble. And he would seek young beautiful women, give enormous amount of debt to their family, and then realize, knowing very well they cannot pay back, then he'll go and say, I want your daughter's hand in marriage, and she should become a queen in my palace, and things like that. So there was this little this poor farmer who was in debt, and his daughter was completely immersed in the thought of God and divinity. But she was very beautiful. So the time came where the father couldn't pay back the debt, so the prince comes to her. And this was the game he would play with everyone. When the time comes, he comes to the village and he tells this girl and her father, tells the girl, I give you a choice. My minister here will pick up two pebbles from the ground. There were white, black pebbles on the ground. He said, he's going to pick up a white pebble and a black pebble from the ground. Put it in this bag. You will not know that. You will put your hand in and pick out a pebble. If you pick out the black pebble, then you'll have to marry me. If you pick out the white pebble, I will free you from your dad of all the debt, and I'll let you go. And if you refuse to pick the pebble, then both of you will be imprisoned for life. So there was really no choice. And he looks at the minister, and his crafty minister bends down, and the girl can see this, what's happening. The crafty minister bends down and picks two black pebbles and puts it into his bag, and then says, so the girl has seen two black pebbles going in, and she knows there is no white pebble, so there is no escape. So if we were, sometimes the reason why I'm saying is we come into situations like this where apparently there seems to be no escape from a situation. I have to choose. Come on, this is career. This is my life. This is what is in front of me. And you are talking of God and spirituality. How does that work? So how does this woman, this brilliant young girl, escape from a situation? She has to pick it up. She can't say no. And if she picks up two pebbles, both are black, she has to either marry or he will put an end to her dad. So she prays and goes into the zone, if you will. And she approaches the minister who holds a bag. She puts her hand in, picks out a pebble with the palms closed. And then as she approaches the prince to show him, she accidentally drops the pebble. And she says, oops, I'm so sorry, forgive me. The prince says, what do you mean you dropped the pebble? Which pebble you dropped? Where is it? Now there are so many pebbles, it's lost. She says, Master, whatever is remaining in that bag will be the other pebble. So they open the bag, they find it's a black pebble, and the prince is caught in his own game. So intelligence, however powerful it can be, the pride, however powerful it can be, will come down in the face of divinity. And we have to realize that whatever we have acquired, whatever we have amassed, is a passing phase, and we have to allow it to let it go. Again, Adi Shankara's, these are such powerful stanzas, and we played this Bhajagovindam drama with Swami, and that's why we learned so much just playing this drama with him and singing these verses in his presence. It's very powerful.
मा कुरु धन जन यौवन गर्वम हरति निमेषा काला सर्वम मा कुरु धन जन यौवन गर्वम हरति निमेषा काला सर्वम मायामयमिदं अखिलं Shankara Mauli Swara Shiva Shambho Shankara
is the absolute God for this kind of discrimination. He knew it was all passing, so he went straight to the graveyard, sat. Said, this is where we have to be, why not be there right in the beginning? So that's the amazing power. And he got the name Shiva. From Shava or corpse came Shiva or auspiciousness. All names of gods are adjectives. They're meant to be qualities that it becomes ours as we meditate upon them. So Shiva rose out of Shava. So from that death and despair and apparent darkness came this mighty power of Shiva because of this power of discrimination. That's why he had the snake on one side, he had the Ganges flowing on the other. You see, his whole family, as Swami says, his family is like unity in diversity. You have the lion, you have the snake, you have the peacock, and you have the spear, and you have everything. The entire universe is in that family. So discrimination paves way to another beautiful quality that I learned from Swami, and that was detachment. Amazing sense of detachment. You know, how many of us put our heart and soul into a project and somebody says this is not good, and say, how dare he say that? Hey, he's jealous, he's this, he's that, and we protect what we have worked for so hard. How many of us can, in absolute dispassionate manner, treat our lives and watch events go by? That is true detachment. Bhagawan, at one level, he'll be so intensely involved in your life. At the other second, you'll find him so beautifully detached. He says, you are truly divine, and as divine, you are the eternal witness. If you and I were putting up a play today, and let's say the kids were watching us, and each of us had a role to play, how attached would I be into the role? I mean, once we finish our role, we'll go to the green room behind and switch back into our regular clothes, correct? If we would say, no, I want to stick to this, I just love this role, I want to be the queen and walk around dressed up in that crown or whatever, people are going to laugh at you. But that's what we do every day. We get attached to our image, and sense of detachment is we think, oh, Vairagya is something about giving up the family and going to the forest. But Bhagawan says, no, it is hands in the society, but your head is in the forest. Your head is in the forest. You know that this is, nothing belongs to me. I become an instrument, and all the resources are allocated to me. I'm using that allocated resources. The tank, when it contains the water, what happens to the water over a period of time? Stale. But in a river, water never becomes stale because it's continuously flowing, because there is detachment, absolute detachment. And again, Bhaja Govindam, Shankara brings this out beautifully. He says, be happy if you have to live in a corner of a temple. Be happy with the sky as a roof and the earth as your bed. For a person who has received, who's attained this kind of detachment, what can be a greater joy than the joy of freedom that he experiences? Now, mothers would say, please don't tell these things to our kids. You can't preach detachment to them. They have to study and they have to progress. So contentment, in general, is regarded as a vice, because it is seen as something which will prevent progress. Oh, if I'm content, then where is progress? So Westerner might ask, or even an Indian kid today might ask, there's no Western Eastern today, thanks to Google, everything is becoming one global culture. So we might ask, if you say contentment, then what is the motivation to progress? Bhagawan put it beautifully. He said once, be content with what you possess. Have incessant desire for knowledge. Desire to know, content with possession. I'm happy with this possession. Don't be discontent with what we possess. That's where we make our mistake. But the desire to know will never end. You want to know more. You want to know more about God. You want to know more about... That is a desire, spiritual desire. And as you know more, you become God. And you become more and more content with what we have. Our desire, unfortunately, is not to know more. How can we get more? So that is why we have ceiling on desires. Ceiling on desires is for the possession. Contentment should come with what we possess, but never with what we know. That should be an incessant yearning and a desire. And so in that, you are getting knowledge. The greatest of scientists are the most spiritual, actually, because they are also searching for the same truth. So you can become the best scientist, the best IT guy, because you like to know what it is. You want to know more. How can I use this as a tool for my own spiritual development? And therefore, in that knowledge, you gain more and more wisdom. Work becomes worship. Duty becomes God. But as far as I possess, my lifestyle is very simple. And that's where Swami came from. His personal lifestyle was so simple, it was almost impossible to believe that somebody like that could live such a simple lifestyle. And on the other hand, he wanted to know more. He established educational institutions, medical institutions. That kept growing because that is encouraging kids to understand and know more about themselves. Again, let's go and learn this from Adi Shankara's Bhaj Govindam.
Sura Mandira Taru Mula Nivasaha Shaya Bhutalam Akhilam Vasaha Sura Mandira Taru Mula Nivasaha Shaya Akhilam Vasaha Sarva Parigraha Bhoga Tyaga Sarva Parigraha Bhoga Tyaga Kasya Sukham Na Karoti Viraga
sense and the readiness to give up, can we have or we earn the right to even call upon God? Why doesn't God come into our lives? It's because we are filled with this baggage. We have no room for Him. Imagine you invite somebody to your home and he doesn't have a room to step in. He could probably understand if you're in the middle of moving between two homes. He can understand all the boxes all over the place. He says, no, it's okay. I'll just have a cup of coffee and leave. But if you invite him, please come to my house, stay as long as you like. He's looking around. There's no room to even step in. You think he's going to stay as long as you like? No. He's going to say, I'm sorry, I just got paged. He's going to escape. Ao Gopala Giridhari, we can call when we make room for him. And we have to make room for him when we get this sense of detachment, this readiness to drop anything and everything at his beck and call. You know, throughout, when we spend these days and years with Swami, Swami would tell us, when I call you, if you have a glass in your hand, you should drop it and come immediately. That thought also, oh, where did I place this glass, should not occur to you. And guess what? Every time I thought I will do that, next time he called, I placed the glass carefully and went to him. I never could do that, drop the glass. Almost instantaneous answer is call. Hey, oh, Swami's calling. How's my dress? How am I? And then go. It wasn't instantaneous. It could never happen. But that is where we are. At least I can speak for myself. But if we need to invite God, we need to be constantly in that readiness to detach ourselves. So we learned about discipline. We learned duty. We learned discrimination. We learned detachment. The next most beautiful thing is devotion. You'll ask me probably, how is Swami, what was Swami devoted to? What is he, whom he has to be devoted to? We are devoted to Swami. But what I saw in him was his devotion to his mission. He was so focused, he was so devoted to what he did, that his thought, his word and deed were completely one. Absolutely one. I was talking to Prasad a little earlier, just before we started this morning's program. And what is the secret that he would walk in and the crowd will completely silence itself? How would this 5 feet 4 inches person command that respect? And Swami would say, only because my thought, my word and deed are one. Karman vachas ekam, karman ekam.
Manas
ekam, vachas ekam. Thank you. Manas ekam, vachas ekam, karman ekam, mahatmanam. Manas anyat, vachas anyat, karman anyat. Duratmana. So if your thought is in one place, your word is in one place, and your deed is a completely different thing, then you are not nowhere near divinity. So we could be here, our thoughts could be somewhere else. We could be singing something, we could be sitting in some other, so our body is in one direction, our thought is in one direction, our word is in another direction. How can we really realize divinity? But the laser focus that Swami had, I thought that was his devotion. His devotion to his mission was fascinating. And I think if we bring that devotion into our aspect of us, we can bring devotion into service. You can't say, I don't know what devotion is, I'm doing seva. No, they're not different things. You can be devoted to your service. You can be so focused on what you do. How can I improve my service? When service becomes an attitude, when service becomes an almost an inborn quality into you, then it becomes true service. Not when you plan and say, every Thursday I will go and do soup kitchen. Every Friday I'm going to do that. I'm doing service. But when your spouse asks you for help, you say, I don't have time for it. I have to go here. So service has to become an attitude. You know, there's a very nice story about a five-year-old who goes and says, how much is that candy? She goes into a restaurant and this busy waitress is serving everybody at the counter, maybe like an American diner or something. And she's serving everybody coffee and breakfast. So this kid gets up and says, how much is that candy? And she says, 50 cents. And the kid looks into his pocket. He sees the change he has. And he says, okay, how much is this candy? She says, that's 35 cents. And he says, okay, give me this candy, 35 cents. And she says, all right, take it. And the kid places 50 cents on the table. And she looks at it and she asks the kid, why? Why didn't you take that big candy, which is 50 cents? And the kid says, but what about your tip? When we make room in our own desires for other people, when we give priority, oh my gosh, her tip is also there, so let me settle with some. How? Then that is true service. And only then, in that, when we bring devotion into our service, when we focus into that, when we bring quality into anything that we do, you know, who stops us from being our best? Ourselves. We are the main culprits who stop ourselves from being the best. But if we can constantly improve our own excellence, we bring devotion into our life. And then we take that spirit of devotion and direct it to God and say, help me. Help me. Release me from the cycle of constantly going back and forth into the cycle, what the spiritual masters call the cycle of birth and death. But birth and death doesn't necessarily mean, okay, 70 years of life and then death and again another 70 years of... Every night we go to sleep is a mini death. Every morning we get up is a mini birth. And guess what we do? We have the same shower, the same breakfast, the same... Maybe little menu differences. But see, just look at your cycle every day. How do you do it? We even use the same hand, the same toothpaste, every action of his is almost predictable. And you know how I found this out? Because of my dog. He knows exactly what I do because he's only understanding body language. The day I do something different, his tail will be wagging. Oh, what is this new thing? And I catch myself. If I wear sneakers, he knows I'm going out with him. If I wear leather shoes, he knows I'm going to work. So he knows which pant I wear. If I wear my jeans, he's going to come close to me. If I wear my dress pants, he'll stay away and just watch. He knows I'm going out. Everything that we do has become so predictable that even animals know what you're going to do. That is apunarapi jananam, punarapi maranam. But if we bring creativity with devotion and break from that cycle, that is what is being in the moment, being in meditation, being mindfulness and things like that. If we learn to be there, then we have a chance to escape from the cycle of birth and death. And again, Adi Shankara says this beautifully in his bhajan.
Punarapi jananam, punarapi maranam, punarapi jananam, punarapi maranam, punarapi janani jatare shayanam, iha samsare bahu dustare. Samsare prabhu tustare kripaya pare sai murare vaikuntha pase sai hare vaikuntha pase sai hare vaijayanti mala dhare jayanti mala dhare vaikuntha pate sai hare.
then we will earn this Vaikuntha, this kingdom of heaven that we are looking at. It comes with devotion. But that devotion doesn't mean this Friday night bhajans or the Sunday morning bhajans or what bhajan do I sing. Oh, that bhajan was nice, great feeling. Those are all little sparks of devotion. But if you bring your devotion and improve the quality of your life, if you bring devotion into your work, if you bring devotion in every aspect of your life, then your life itself becomes worship. So there is no separate materialistic life and materialistic practices and spiritual practices. There is no need then to struggle with this. How do I balance spiritual life and materialistic life? Everything becomes spiritual because you're becoming devoted in everything you did. Swami was devoted the way he dressed. In fact, you know, when Prasad was talking about the belt incident, I was reminded Swami would tie his the thread or whatever around to keep the dhoti inside his robe really tight. He would, because it's silk, you know, silk doesn't stay with your skin. Cotton, it's easy. And so he would tie it so tight that there would be a very deep mark on his skin. Sometimes there would be rashes. So he would, you know, I found cream then. And one day Radhakrishna told me, this is all because Swami has a deep rash here. So one day, one of my brothers asked Swami, Swami, why do you want to tie it so fast? So much, Swami, just keep it loose. And Swami laughed. He said, you're going for darshan or I'm going for darshan? Are people touching your feet or my feet? When you go for darshan, they'll pull anything and everything. I need to keep the dhoti intact. So even there, he took a lot of pain upon himself. Believe me, it's almost, if you really see Swami's life, you'll say, I'm happy where I am. But that is the kind of devotion he brought into every aspect, the way he dressed, the way he looked, the way he walked, the way he talked, the way he read, the way he lived his life. And finally, the last D, we are running out of D's and we are running out of time. So the last D, the most powerful, is dedication. We can have discipline, we can have duty, we can have discrimination, we can have detachment, we can have devotion. But until we are able to dedicate everything and anything that we have earned in our life, we are ready to dedicate it, drop it at His feet, with no sense of me and my and I and mine and thine, whatever. We are able to dedicate to Guru Charanambuja if we go and live it at the feet of the Guru. That is all that's needed. And believe me, it sounds very easy. Sounds very nice to hear it. But dedicating, that is unconditionality. Can you stand in the presence of the Master unconditionally, with no conditions? Absolutely. If he says jump, you jump. Into a cliff, just jump. That we'll be ready to do, because that's an extreme. I know it's never going to happen. But you might say, small little things and we'll cling to it. Unconditional acceptance of the Guru's will. That is the secret to liberation. Let us sing this bhajan and offer ourselves during this bhajan to Swami's feet. And once again, thank you so much for this opportunity to share these small little perspectives.
Guru Charanambuja Nirbhara Bhakta Samsara Tachira Bhavamo Guru Charanambuja Nirbhara Bhakta Samsara Tachira Bhavamo Sendriya Manasa Niyama Devam Sendriya Manasa Niyama Devam Drakshasi Nita Hridaya Sandeva Drakshasi Hridaya Sandevam Jai Panduranga Prabhu Vithala Jagadodara Hari Vithala Jai Panduranga Prabhu Jagadodara Hari Vithala Panduranga Vithala Pandharinath Vithala Sri Ram.
Thank you, Brother Sundar, for sharing with us valuable 5 D's, discipline, duty, discrimination, devotion, and dedication. It was very valuable. Please give a warm round of applause for Brother Sundar.